Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
At the very end of the show, I didn't handle myself too well with that Patrick rat.
He got you to say something embarrassing, didn't he? What was it?
That Alan Brady is bald.
Huh? You say he had no hair? On television? Honey. Oh, sweetheart, you knew that was a secret, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. What's the fun in telling if it's not a secret?
But Rob, he tricked me.
Oh, he tricked you. All right, he tricked you. Oh, he's very, very tricky. But telling the whole world about Alan's wig, oh, are we in trouble?
Well, Rob, you saw the way he asked those questions. I mean, you just hardly know how to answer them. Rob, I just don't know what to do.
Answer the phone. Alan will tell you what to do. Whoa. Oh, buddy. Huh? How'd you find out? But Sal, how did she... She read it in the newspaper. Anyway, buddy, huh? Oh, boy. Okay, well, listen, I'll see you tomorrow. Maybe. Thanks a lot, pal.
Well,
the item in the paper said, the question of whether Alan Brady is bald or not was answered today on television by the wife of the future ex-writer of the Alan Brady show.
Hey everybody, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. For countless generations, show business legend Dick Van Dyke has been entertaining us for nearly 70 years with the Emmy Award-winning Dick Van Dyke Show, and he's living proof that life does get better the longer you live it. Dick's optimistic outlook is an invigorating tonic for anyone who needs a reminder that life should be lived with enthusiasm despite what the calendar says. And truly, he is an American icon, and Dick Van Dyke is joining us tonight. Dick, how are you, my friend?
I'm just great, Dave. Good to talk to you, Dave.
Oh, same here. You know, growing up watching television, watching the movies, your work has really, honestly, earned you the title of a true American icon. I'm so honored you're spending some time with us tonight.
Is that funny? It must be good genes. I don't know what else.
Okay, fair enough. Well, you know, I know you're raised right here in Danville, Illinois. Your dad worked for the Sunshine Biscuit Company. You just helped save your childhood home that was going to be demolished. How cool is that?
It was an old house when I grew up in it. It must have been built around the turn of the century. But somebody noticed it and decided it ought to be preserved, formed some kind of a group, and are raising funds to see it. I'm afraid I just had nothing to do with it, but I am. You know, when the folks you were raised with recognize that it's a new one. Emmy's one thing, but that's more important. This from your hometown.
Yeah, they said, you know, they got this new foundation. They want to provide scholarships to accomplish young performers in your name, and I can't think of a better way to honor you. That's a very cool thing.
You'll have to take my advice and not do what I did.
Well,
train, for God's sake.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what you did, because, you know, this long, amazing life of yours and why you keep moving and continuing to have the time of your life, it's about moving and keeping things forward. You worked in radio first, which I found fascinating. It was like World War II. You were 16 years old when many of the newsmen and disc jockeys on the air were drafted. They needed to recruit new talent, and at 16 years old, you got your first job on the air.
I got the job. I loved it. I have to tell you a story. After the war, must have been 45 or so, I actually got an audition at your station. I took the train to Chicago, checked into just a flea bag hotel I could afford, and left a call. They didn't call me. And I missed the audition, and I got on the train, came home. It was going to be my big break. I was going to be at WGN, and I missed it altogether.
Oh, my.
So I became a comedian instead.
So you became a comedian. Well,
isn't that funny?
It is. That's a wild story. And, you know, so you're performing on Broadway in the 60s, early 60s, Bye Bye Birdie. Sheldon Leonard and Carl Reiner saw your performance. And at that time, there was a sitcom pilot floating around written by and starring Carl, called Head of the Family, which eventually became the Dick Van Dyke Show. How did that meeting and all that come about?
Actually, I don't think I even met them that night. They didn't come back. I heard, Carl sent me about 8 scripts he had written, and I had a little idea of my own, which I threw out the window. I've read some of the best writing I've ever read. I don't know why I think CBS told him, we like the show, but get a better actor.
That happens. I mean, that happens. You know, you got great ideas, but they want to bring someone else into the role. And you knew, obviously, your show shows in Sid Caesar, so you know how good the writing was going to be with Carl, right?
God, yes. For 5 years, I wouldn't leave the house on Saturday night because of your show of shows.
Sure.
You know, you couldn't tape it back then. You either saw it then or not. I would not leave the house. That was, I think, a real milestone. They changed the face of television comedy with that show.
They did, and it's funny you say that because, you know, with all the reruns that are out there, and, you know, you see the Lucys in your show and so forth, but that's in the Honeymooners, but that's one that doesn't get a lot of play, like from a syndication standpoint, and really was one of the most brilliantly written
shows. There's only 10 shows left.
Oh.
They destroyed them all.
Oh, isn't that something?
I can't, but there were 10, and the rest were all, the Kennys were destroyed. That's really tragic.
Yeah, it is tragic. It is. And no one could figure out, really, they weren't going to use Head of the Family. They really didn't know what to call the show, and nobody really knew at that point who Dick Van Dyke was, but they settled on that. But they settled on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah, well, we couldn't think of a name, but Double Trouble and things of that kind. Everything we thought of was pretty corny. So I think that was part of the reason we failed the first season. Nobody knew what a Dick Van Dyke was. That's what Rose Marie said when they asked her about doing on the show. She said, what's a Dick Van Dyke?
That's great. That's great. Well, speaking of which, you know, Maury Amsterdam, Rose Marie were already cast in the show. They weren't in the pilot, but they were cast for the new show. How great. What amazing talents to be able to work with, right?
I've never fallen into such a perfect blend of a performer. We were like an improv group.
Yeah.
God, they were good. It was such fun.
That's awesome. And I know Mary Tyler Moore was, 23 years old at the time when she was auditioning?
I was 12 years older.
Wow.
I said, God, I didn't feel a little young. But the funny thing is, on the 5 years, nobody ever said, isn't he a little for her?
Well, and the chemistry was amazing between the two of you, but at first you weren't sure she could do comedy. I mean, that really wasn't her background, but she really did show everybody she could do it.
I know. Even she didn't know she could do comedy.
Yeah.
She was just, her time, of course she had Rosie and Maury and Carl Reiner, a lot of people who knew what they were doing, and it just rubbed off on her.
Well, I'll tell you, the character of Rob Petrie, how much of Rob Petrie was Dick Van Dyke?
Quite a bit. Carl always said that they wrote Yiddish and we played British. Jewish sense of something. It's hard to put. Jewish wisdom, Jewish experience.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and then we had, and then we did it American. But I played a guy who had a lot of child inside. He was intelligent and a nice guy, but he had a childlike fear of authority and not a lot of confidence in himself outside of his own, bailiwick.
Yeah.
And I'd love to play in that.
Well, I will tell you, I mean, the show, though, stands on its own almost 60 years later. There's some shows that, because of dated material and so forth, it's hard to watch today. You know it's from another era. That show, the writing, is so amazing that it completely is one of those shows that stands up today.
Carl did that on purpose. He didn't want any jokes of the day, any mention of the news of the day. And even the clothes are starting to look the same again. They're coming back.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. No, it's true. It's totally true. Now, I have to tell you, when the show opens, now my kids are 14, 10, and just about 4 years old. And when the show starts, they pause it in the beginning, and they literally place bets. Is he going to trip? Is he going to skip around? Is he going to almost make it? Which is it going to be? And they all, I swear, they should be playing for money.
You know, a lot of people did. Yeah. A lot of people gambled on that.
Yeah. What a fun way, though, to just get you engaged right at the front of the show.
Yeah, it really was. Of course, Carl hadn't written any physical comedy at all, but he, out of deference to my love for it, he let me do it.
And, you know, you were mentioning earlier, first season, 39 episodes, which 39 episodes in one season is, of course, unheard of today. I mean, now they're doing like 13, 9 episodes.
I know. And, you know, Carl wrote every one of them.
Oh, that's amazing. That is absolutely
He was calling for help by the second season.
I bet he was. Now, Maury, and I know this because I've seen you perform with the Fantastics, your a cappella group, which we'll talk about in a little bit. He wrote lyrics to the show that were never published.
Never published. It's so sad. So we're spreading the word now. We sing them.
I know you do. I'm going to ask you. Do you got a little bit of that for us?
Okay. So you think that you got trouble? Well, trouble's a bubble. So tell all Mr. Trouble to get lost. Why not hold your head up high and stop crying, start trying, and don't forget to keep your fingers crossed. When you find the joy of living is loving and giving, you'll be there when the winning dice are tossed. A smile is just a frown that's turned upside down. So smile on that frown or defrost. And don't forget to keep your fingers crossed.
Ba-da-da.
And then I called on.
That's fantastic.
The sweetest lyrics. He never even mentioned it to anybody.
Dick, I know Walt Disney called you personally about the part of Bert in Mary Poppins.
He did. I thought it was because I had been singing and dancing. He had simply heard a quote of mine about the dearth of decent family entertainment. So knowing I could sing and dance, he said, well, that's the guy I want. And that day when I went in and the Sherman Brothers played that score for me, and they showed, of course, he had all the scenes in watercolor all over the walls of his office. I walked out of there on the air. My God, I just knew it was going to be a great movie.
But, I mean, it was Walt Disney himself reached out to you personally and said, come on down. And they were playing, like they were selling you almost on the part.
We became very good friends. Kind of we were on the opposite sides of the political fence, but still, he was a big kid. He was really a child inside, an old shoe of a kind of a guy. We just talked and talked and talked together.
Now, I know there was an amazing amount of singing and dancing, the Cockney accent. Did you have a lot of time to prepare at that time in the movies, or did you really just go into rehearsal and then hit it?
No, we had lots of time on the dance numbers, the rooftops, I think. They built the stage out of plywood out in the back lot. And we spent about 6 weeks on that. I spent one evening on the accent. They hired an Irishman as a coach, Pat O'Malley, who was no better than I.
To teach you the Cockney accent.
Tweet, not that last summer there was a tweet with Judi Dench and Jeremy Irons and a bunch of great British actors. They were asked, who did the worst British accent in the history of movies? I won, hands down.
Congratulations.
So I said, I wrote him back and said, it's great to be number one.
It is great to be number one.
Yeah, they were so cute about it.
What is the hardest part about getting older, Dick? I mean, there's some things you have given up, and tennis and some other things, but, I mean, you still go work out. You get up at 6 o'clock in the morning typically every day. You got a key to your own gym. They gave you a key, for God's sake, so you can get in there early and work out.
That's sometime there before the owners get
awesome.
There.
I
go in, turn on the lights, do my thing, and then close up again.
Yeah.
But there's some other guys that usually show up. I like to have somebody to talk to. But as I say in the book, it isn't the exercise, it's the getting there.
Yeah.
You'll talk yourself right out of it.
Yeah.
And I said, if you only do 10 minutes, start getting there, and you'll be amazed how fast you come around. 90-year-olds can do it. It doesn't matter.
It's true.
And you need that oxygen blood going through the brain, too.
Yeah, and a great way to start your day.
Oh, yeah, you come back feeling younger.
Yeah. Now,
and I thing. I sing all the time. A lot of my friends, you, as you get older, you don't speak much, and their voices get very, very weak. And that's why I get up in the morning and start singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning."
That's awesome.
Well,
that's
a beautiful day, I mean.
You know what? I had met you briefly about 10 years ago. You were walking through Palm Springs. I don't know why you were in Palm Springs. You had like a fanny pack, a backpack on, and you were walking down that street like you had your whole life ahead of you. There was a spring in your step that just motivated me. And I said, boy, this guy just, he knows how to live life. He just does.
Isn't that great? Yeah, I think a lot of older guys just throw in the towel before they should.
They do. Now, hobbies are important, too, and to keep up and keep your brain going. And you talk about a little bit about what you like doing. You work on 3D animation. Talk about open minds. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I started about 20 years ago. They came out with a little toy, and I've got just stuck with it. And now, of course, I'm using a program that they use in the movies. I'm not that good. But it's the process. Anything that you can lose hours in without realizing it is a good hobby.
Now, singing is also part. You say you sing every morning. The Fantastics. By the way, there's an album out there that you can buy. There's videos out there of people that have taped you recording with I think it's about four or five other younger guys. And you guys do all kinds of a cappella songs. You do a lot of your favorites from the Mary Poppins and the Chitty Chitty Bang Bangs. But you do a lot of...
Oh, yeah. People love to hear that.
Oh, it's... Yeah, they do. They do. But you do a lot of other great songs, too. And it's Put on a Happy... It's all very positive, motivating songs that you're singing.
Well, we have such a good time. I love to harmonize, and these guys, they came to me.
Well, I'll tell you, with 90 years on the planet, any regrets, any things in life you would do over now that you've kind of learned just a little bit about yourself and life itself?
Well, I would never smoke and I would never drink. I had to battle through both of those things, and for some reason I turned down a movie with one of my idols, Cary Grant. I must have been busy or drunk. I don't know. But I didn't do the movie. It was one of those light, Doris Day kind of comedies. But, God, I just to be able to say I worked with him.
Yeah. No, I get that. But those are two big things in life that you learn. But the smoking, you smoked for a long time. But I think... but you keep moving and you keep active, and it's that the dancing and singing and everything else, that breathing that has helped rebuild your lungs and made you a stronger individual.
I think that is what saved me, the fact that I was always in movement, breathing.
Yeah.
I see the AMA just released a new list of things to do to prevent Alzheimer's, and exercise is number one.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's the fastest growing disease that's out there for that generation, and it's pretty scary. That's a good tip as well. Dick, it has been such an honor and to have this opportunity to spend some time with you this evening.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN. A true television icon that we all grew up with is the legendary Barbara Eden, best known from 5 seasons in the NBC hit comedy series I Dream of Jeannie. But it was nearly a decade earlier that she got her start in an RKO film called Back from Eternity, and the following year made one of her first television appearances on I Love Lucy. She has starred in dozens of feature films and television series with co-stars like Elvis Presley, Paul Newman, Lucille Ball, Clint Eastwood, Larry Hagman, Tony Randall, John Forsythe, and so many others. Then there was Vegas, Atlantic City, and on the theater scene throughout the country. And she even lived right here in Chicago for a number of years. And joining us tonight to talk about her storied career is the legendary actress herself, singer and Hollywood star, Barbara Eden. Hello there, Barbara, and welcome to the program.
Hi, David. How are you?
I am excellent. I'm so glad that you're joining us tonight. And I will admit to having a big crush on you growing up.
Oh, you mean you don't still have it?
I still have it. Oh, no. I still have the crush. No, we were talking before the interview that I had the pleasure of spending some time with you a few years ago when you were in Chicago, and you are just as lovely as ever.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. So how did the role of Jeannie come along?
Well, I had been reading about it and the trade magazines, you know, Variety Reporter, and reading about all these girls who were testing, and they were all very tall brunettes and beauty contest winners. I mean, Miss Italy, Miss Syria, Miss Israel, Miss Greece. You know?
So some exotic, you know.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, well, that's not for me. Mm-hmm. And then my agent sent me a script one day, and I read it, and I thought, this sounds very familiar. And he called me that afternoon, and he said, did you read it? I said, yes. He said, did you like it? I said, I loved it. He said, well, they would really like you for that part, just like that. And I said, do they know what I look like? And he said, well, I don't know. They must, because they want you for the part. They've made an offer. But it's contingent upon you meeting Sidney Sheldon. He's lives in New York, and he's coming into town, and he'll be there tomorrow for tea at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Oh, nice.
And I said, all right. And I went over, and I met Sidney. We got along very well, and that's how I got the part.
Now, were you pregnant at the time of the pilot or right after?
No, it was after.
Okay.
It was after. It was quite a bit after. And the doctor actually gave me the news that I was pregnant, which I was thrilled. I was just over the moon. We had tried so long to have a baby. And then my agent called and said the show has sold on the same day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that night I called Sidney and said, I have to talk to you. Talk to you right now. And he was having dinner at someone's home, a well-known writer. I can't think of his name. Oh, Buck Henry.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's at Buck Henry's house, and he told me where to go, and I met him there, went into his little office at the side, and he looked at me and jokingly said, yeah, you're pregnant, like that. And I said, yes. And I can't do your show, with a big grin on my face.
Wow.
Which was terrible.
Yeah.
And he said, no. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, it just, this is unusual for us, but we're very happy that we're going to have a baby. And I was the luckiest girl in the world, because Sidney and the studio worked very hard to get everything ready faster than they would have.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 13 shows pregnant.
In that costume. So I would have to think there was some pretty creative blocking or standing behind things.
Oh, that plus many, many scarves.
Oh.
I laughed. I used to call myself a walking tent. I flowed with scarves.
You know, if I had to think about it, I guess in the black and white episodes, the early episodes, you did have these long, very glamorous, like 5-foot scarves kind of flowing around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I stood in back of a lot of chairs. And one time, it was funny, Gene Nelson was directing us, and he was a dear friend at the time. And his wife still is my good friend. But they had chosen a red bathing suit, a two-piece, for me to wear. And it was all set out there, and I looked at it, and I looked at Joey, the girl who was in charge of wardrobe, and I said, Joey, I can't wear that. And she said, well, just try it on. Let's see what it looks like. I put it on. It was horrible. It was just so embarrassing. I said, no, tell Jean I can't wear the bathing suit. I mean, God, I was 5 months pregnant. That's terrible.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So Jean came running over to my dressing room and said, Barbara, you've never been a diva. What's the matter? And I said, well, I can't wear the bathing suit. I hadn't made a big deal out of it. You know, I just said no. Yeah. And I said, I can't wear it. I'm pregnant, Gene. I guess he'd forgotten during all the shooting. And he said, well, put it on. I said, I'll put it on. I will not walk out in front of the crew. I said, you come here and see it. And he said, okay. So I put the thing on. I put a robe on over it. And when he came over to the door, I just flashed him. I opened it. I said, see? And I closed it again. And he went, oh, yeah, you're right.
That's great.
I think what they did was put me in a tire tube on my tummy.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, on the side of the pool.
Yeah. Why not?
That was it.
Since so many of us have seen these episodes, Barbara, over and over throughout the years, you can tell that the cast had such great chemistry together.
Well, Larry and I were in sync. Even later, in later years, when we toured with Love Letters, it was like it was as though I was just at home with a family member. And I know he felt the same way. Our rhythms, our timing, everything was in sync.
Yeah, you've done plays together. You also did some Dallas together. I remember that also in the late 70s. And I know how much you enjoyed working with him, and you had a long-lasting friendship. But at that time, you had some frustrations with him as well.
Well, not really. I didn't really. A lot of other people on the set did.
Mm-hmm.
He made things a little difficult for himself, really. But it never, never affected me or our working together, ever.
Well, that's good to hear.
He was very, very nice with me.
Very cool. Now, how complicated was all the filming? You know, because obviously, you know, we're talking the 1960s, and special effects weren't, you know, obviously what they are today. They look great. I mean, even when you look at them today, it's amazing how smooth everything really does look, you know, when you're doing these. But it wasn't, you know, I would assume because it wasn't a typical sitcom, the hours were much longer.
Much longer, yes.
Yeah.
It was. And we couldn't have an audience.
Right.
Because of the magic. And it was. It was very complicated. When we were flying through the air, we were really flying through the air.
Exactly.
With wires attached, mm-hmm. things like that. A lot of green screen, which we had to adapt to. It didn't adapt to us. It was fun, though. I enjoyed it.
You know, it was a purely fun show. There are shows I used to love when I was a kid. You know, and I know some of you listening will agree, and you watch them now, and they're awful. I mean, seriously, like, I can't get through. You know, my kids were watching Gilligan's Island. I thought, well, I'm going to sit down and watch this, or The Monkees. And I thought, this is going to be fun. And I got to tell you, it wasn't really that great. You watch Genie, and it is timeless as can be. It is funny as it was back then. And the slapstick, the comedy, the humor, the writing is just a joy to watch.
I am so happy you think so.
Yeah, seriously.
That makes me feel really good.
I bet. Now, I've heard you talk about the costume before, that it wasn't as revealing as you might think. It was, you know, people, and maybe that was a good thing, that, you know, you kind of led people to believe that it might be a little bit more revealing, but it really wasn't. And the press at the time made a bigger deal out of it than anyone else.
Well, it was a joke to begin with. It was a writer from the Hollywood Reporter, and he'd come on the set, and he'd say, do you have a belly button? And I'd say, Nicola Peek, you know. Things were very cheap then.
Yeah.
and so he'd started writing about it, just as a joke.
Yeah.
Does she or doesn't she have a belly button? And, of course, it peeked out every once in a while. It was there. The trousers were not up at the high waist. They were just sort of riding on my hips.
Yeah.
And then George Slaughter decided he wanted to premiere my navel on Laugh-In.
Right.
And the minute he told NBC that, everyone went, MG, yeah. she has one? You know, can't show that. So I was not allowed to go on Laugh-In. I wasn't allowed. And they suddenly were very careful about my trousers. They lined the pantaloons.
Oh, jeez.
Which hadn't been lined before. They, you know, I had panties and long pantyhose on.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
So, but no, they lined them.
Even more so. Wow. Well, I know the censors, they were pretty aware of this, too, because, you know, there was a story I've heard you tell, I think it was in your book, too, that about the smoke underneath the bedroom door.
Oh, yes, Larry.
Yeah.
Poor Larry. He had a scene, of course, where the bottle was in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And was the bottle in the bedroom? No, it wasn't. It wasn't in the bedroom. But he locked me out, and I turned to smoke and went underneath the door. And you could hear Larry's voice, but not me. And he said, Jeannie! You know how he used to say.
Oh, yeah.
And then all of a sudden the smoke came out. from under the door. And it was funny.
It was
cute to see it.
I get it.
Happen.
Yeah.
But no, the censor said absolutely not. They cut that scene. And then they said no bottle in the bedroom.
Wow.
We hadn't even thought of taking the bottle in the bedroom before that. It's so funny.
Wow.
Well, it's amusing.
It is. But, I mean, obviously the two characters got together, you know, and I know it kept it interesting that for so many years you weren't married. There was maybe some light flirting and all that. But at toward the end they said, well, you know what, we're gonna bring these characters together and get married. Were you fond of that?
No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't think they should ever have been married. As I said before, she wasn't human.
Right.
Absolutely, it was not human. And that was what was funny about the show, was she was so convinced that she would be a person, a human person.
Sure.
Not a genie person.
Right.
And it just made her a housewife, and that isn't what she was.
No, not at all. So what was your relationship like with some of the other supporting characters on the show? I know many, many of them are gone, but, you know, what was it like working on the set?
It was wonderful. That was the happiest time of my life at that moment. I had my baby, I had my work, and I enjoyed it, and everyone on that set was an angel.
I know you're still friends with Bill Daly. You still see him around
I just saw Bill 2 weeks ago, actually.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. He lives in New Mexico, but we see each other every once in a while at personal appearances and things.
That's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's so cool. How did you find out, and you shared the story with me before, how did you find out the series was canceled? Because, you know, today there's so many, you know, oh, it's the lead up to the final episode and all this other stuff. That's really not the way it was done back then.
Nobody told us anything.
Yeah.
No, we didn't know. The last day, I think, we knew. The last day of shooting.
Wow.
Yeah.
That it was just coming to an end, no fanfare, no final episode. It's just
no, that's it just willowed away.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a shame. That's how they did it back then. Did you get any souvenirs from the set? Did you get, you know, any prop pieces? Like, was everything just the next day pretty much done?
Of course I did.
Yeah.
Of course I did.
I got
my bottle.
Okay.
You think I was going to leave that? Heavens.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I had it. It's now in a safety deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
Because after the earthquake here, I thought,
smart.
We're not going to leave it on the shelf anymore.
No. Was the original, that was a Jim Beam bottle, wasn't it?
That is correct.
Yeah.
It was a Christmas bottle that year.
I have a very vintage bar in my house, like a 1960s bar, and it was green. I think there was green ones and red ones.
I didn't know they had red ones.
Yeah, they're red, and they had a little handle on them too, which was a little different. But there was like a pink one. It was almost like a pinkish red. And the green ones, and I had bought from somebody who's authorized through Sony, who hand-painted these bottles. And when I had met you, I must have been 10 years ago, you were at WGN Television,
mm-hmm.
And I was there. And I have a picture of you and I and my bottle.
And your bottle.
That I have.
You just think it's your bottle.
It is your bottle. It is absolutely your bottle. Well, what's funny is after showing the kids the show last summer when we watched it so much, and they came up to my den where I do have it on a shelf high enough where nobody can get to it. My youngest, you know, I opened up the cork, and man, he was looking in there trying to see if he could find you. And they're like, he was.
You know, someone makes those bottles.
Yeah.
And sells them.
Yeah.
And he has one with the hole, the banquette, and the genie looking up at you.
Really?
Yeah, you turn the light on and you can see all the little things inside.
That's awesome. That is awesome. But you didn't get a costume.
No.
No.
No, I didn't. They, in fact, they would not let me have one.
That's awful.
It's too bad because they didn't take good care of them. And there aren't any there. I did a commercial for Lexus.
Remember that in the late 90s?
Yes, mm-hmm. And they copied the costume. So luckily I have that one.
Well, I saw you in an appearance with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, that's the one.
did you use it again? But I mean, I got to tell you something. You look fabulous. I mean, if you look online, folks, you can see it on YouTube. It is amazing. You look fabulous. You still look fabulous. Oh, yes, you do. Oh, I got to tell you, you do. You absolutely do.
I really had to suck it up to do that. I was so nervous about wearing that costume.
Oh, you looked great. You really did. You looked fantastic.
Well, it was for a good cause.
Well, I Dream of Jeannie can be seen multiple times a day on Antenna TV, and I Dream of Jeannie, the complete series, is available on DVD. And for more on Barbara, and she's got a great website too, visit BarbaraEden.com. Barbara, what a great thrill it has been to have you hang out with us early this morning. Always a pleasure hanging
thank
out with you.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. So nice. It's fun talking to you.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. The pleasure is all mine.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. 5 passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour. Weather started getting rough, the tiny ship was tossed. If not for the courage of the fearless crew, the minnow would be lost, the minnow would be lost. The ship's aground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle with Gilligan.
It's Dave Player on 720 WGN. So Gilligan's Island, the iconic 1960s television series that only lasted 3 seasons and 98 episodes, has lasted 50 years and countless generations of fans. As a sweet, polite, and thoughtful character of Marianne from Kansas, Dawn Wells created an unforgettable and beloved character that still connects with people 5 decades later. And TV Guide ranked Dawn on the 50 sexiest stars of all times list, and she joins us tonight. Hello there, Dawn.
Hello, hello, hello. You know, it really is. I mean, good girl sounds like goody two-shoes. But, you know, when we were when we first got stranded on the island, the birth control pill wasn't even invented.
It wasn't.
So imagine if you drop Marianne today with Miley Cyrus on the piano top, topless, or whatever's going on. Wow, what an adjustment.
You would have had to use a coconut. I don't know what you would have used. I mean, you were they were very inventive, the writers back then.
Yes, they were. And we were pretty good that I could make a coconut cream pie with no cow.
That's right, right, right. That's true. That's
right.
True. Now, I grew up in the 70s, and I discovered the show in reruns here on WGN Television in Chicago. And the choice between Marianne and Ginger was always very easy for me because Ginger just seemed way, way, way too high maintenance, like just way too much trouble. It was always Marianne for me.
Well, don't you think maybe it's your age? I mean, don't you think maybe if you were 30 or something and wanted to go out rock and rolling or dancing or buying a cocktail, it would be a Ginger?
No.
I don't know. So
mm-mm.
I was very impressed mm-mm. because she was a movie star. And, you know, I'd seen Gods of the Laker that she did with Rock Hudson, and I was, wow, we have this beautiful movie star on the island. And yet, the question always is Marianne or Ginger, and I don't mean to be egotistical, but I usually always win. But
you
I would
do.
Have been your best friend, too, you know.
You...
I would cook, I would clean, I'd go to the Boy Scout meeting with you, we'd go to prom. I mean, I think there was a, she'd be your friend.
Absolutely.
Let's put it that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought of as even as a 14-year-old kid, that was the route to go. You know, the last time I saw you was a couple years ago when you were here in Chicago, and I got to tell you, you look fabulous.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It gets harder every year, but I'm very lucky. I'm very healthy. I'm very happy. I'm very optimistic. And, you know, worries and troubles and everything make a difference in how you age, and I don't seem to have any at this point, knock wood.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, before we dive deep into the book, you know, a little background on you. You first grew up in Reno, Nevada.
In Reno, Nevada, where there was gambling and divorce and prostitution was legal, and a Marianne came out of that. But my mother raised a Marianne. I had rules. We didn't have the internet, and people hide in their rooms and say things that you as a parent don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother kept an eye on me. My parents were divorced when I was 4. Mother and father were good friends. I lived in Reno. My dad lived in Las Vegas. My stepmother and mother were both concerned if I got a cold. That's very rare today. And when I look at that and think, that's what helps. The family is a family.
Absolutely.
You might have had a grandmother that raised you that made a difference, you know? So
right.
I really feel very fortunate.
I agree with you, and it is all about the family. How did you find your way now from Reno to Stevens College in Missouri? Because you kind of made your way through Missouri and then Seattle. What attracted you to Stevens College?
Well, I was an only child. My mm-hmm. parents, my father didn't adopt children until I was 16. So I was an only child, and no brothers and sisters. And I just wanted to go to a girls' school. And my father said, no, not in high school because you need to know what boys are, you know, how they respond. And only child, you know, if you've got a brother and sister and you fight over a toy, your brother and sister is going to be there tomorrow. If you fight over a toy and it's next door neighbor, they may never come back. So I was very conscious of wanting to live dormitory style with a bunch of people. And I was accepted to Stanford. In my generation, that was tough. And Mills College, which was both of them very close to Reno. And one of the admissions counselors came from Missouri to Reno High. And I went, whoa, now here's a girl's school halfway across the country.
Yeah.
I'm going. And I want to tell you how old-fashioned it was. We caught the train in San Francisco. And the train went from San Francisco to Los Angeles, all through Arizona, all the way to Missouri, picking up Stevens girls all the way.
Wow.
So by the time we got there, 4 days later, you had 100 friends.
That's
it was
cool.
A wonderful experience.
It was
concentrated on what you could be without competing with the boys.
Sure, sure. But then you went on to University of Washington in Seattle, where you got your degree in theater, and you were crowned Miss Nevada in 1959. I mean, that's pretty cool in and of itself.
Well, I say it's no big deal. There are probably only 10 women in the state.
Okay.
California, probably 150 girls competed for. But no, I they asked me to run. I thought, this is so silly. I'm short and I'm little, and you've got all these beautiful, tall, long-legged women. But I thought, being a theater major, see if I could get up in front of all these people and do a scene and not be nervous about it. And that's really the reason I entered.
Now, at what point in your life did you say, you know, I want to be on stage, I want to be in theater? Was it in college, or was it even before that?
Well, and I like medicine a lot. If I were doing it all over, I might go into genetics. So Washington had a great med school. And when I graduated with a degree in theater, I said, I'll give myself 1 year. And I analyzed it. I ran a camp in Idaho talking about how do you pick where you're going to go. And most of New York was musical comedy, and I don't sing. I thought, okay, let's go to Los Angeles, and I'll give myself a year. And if I don't go to work, I'll come back to med school. And I went to work right away, but the first thing I did was a play with Mercedes in Cambridge. And I was doing the play right in Hollywood, and agents came to see me. And Warner Brothers put me under option to contract, which means they didn't pick up the contract, but I did 9 shows in a row, so I had that film experience. And from that point on, I just worked solid.
I know, that's pretty cool. I mean, at a very, very young age, I mean, right really out of college, you were doing episodes of 77 Sunset Strip, the Maverick, Bonanza. That's pretty cool. How did Gilligan's Island come along?
Well, I don't know how long after I came to Hollywood it came along, because I was doing a lot of work. But there was a call out for, there were 3 replacements. It were 3 school teachers, I think, and CBS said, fine, but let's rewrite. So they created a Ginger, a Professor, and a Marianne. And I was just one of the 4,000 girls that went up for Marianne. And we tested at CBS Television City, and we tested with both Gingers and Marianne all day long for about 5 days. Every ingenue, every sex symbol were all there, and they tried to match with even the professor. Russell used to tell me, the vice president used to say to him, Russell, take off your shirt. No, I'm not going to take off my shirt. So I think they were looking for muscle men, too. I don't know what they were looking for.
Yeah.
But it went on for a week, and I got the part. You know, I don't know. I was lucky, but I also have a perfect type, and I say that to students. I was very well trained. I knew my craft, but I also looked like a Marianne.
Yeah.
You know, Ginger, no matter how good she be, could be as an actress, you would never cast her as a Marianne.
Right. Right.
So that physical stuff does make a difference, I think.
Sure. Now, at first season, you were just credited at the beginning as the rest. And
yes, I'm still the rest. No. Yeah, and the professor and I used to send each other cards, love the rest. But after the first year, and I don't know who takes the credit. Gilligan took the Bob took the credit. One of the directors took the credit, and Sherwood said, this is silly. There's 7 people on an island. So they rewrote the credits. But I wasn't uptight about that. I mean, I don't have that kind of an ego. You do your job and you do the best you can, and you can't manipulate the business. You don't know what's going to happen.
But what's funny is, because we all grew up with 3 channels back then, is that the large amount of audience that saw that show compared to today. I mean, you know, it's so, you know, diverse on all the entertainment that you can have. But back then, and even in the 70s and in the early 80s through the reruns, I mean, you know, the communal experience of watching some of these shows and growing up with them, you recognize stuff like that because you saw these episodes 500 times.
That's right. And the whole family watched it together.
Yeah.
And I look at it and I still laugh, because we really had a talented cast.
Yeah, yeah.
And it blended perfectly. I mean, the casting was perfect, and each character was so specific.
Well,
a lot of the shows, we had the Partridge Family and the Monkees and Father Knows Best and all of that. But it was so unique that we were on this island with all these clothes and coconut cream pies.
Yeah, it was a different type of story than the usual family, you know, sitcom. Tell me about your relationship with some of the folks on the cast. Tell me about Bob Denver.
He was an incredible guy. Very, very, very smart.
Yeah, you were close to him.
Yeah, and he was very, very selective. Very few people were invited to his home. He was very, very private. And Bob and I just really connected. He was a genius at what he did. And I'm going to ask you this question because I'm sure you don't know the answer. I think sometimes when you're a genius in whatever category you are, you're not necessarily gregarious or trivial conversation is a bore, blah, blah, blah. Well, do you know who Charlie Chaplin's best friend was?
Uh-uh.
Albert Einstein.
Really?
And that, yeah, and I was doing some research for doing a historical thing I was doing, and I went, wow, but think of the two brains together.
Right.
I mean, they're both geniuses in whatever they do, but yet they found each other. And I really think that Bob, he did Maynard, G. Krebs, mm-hmm, woo, all mm-hmm. that. But not only, there wasn't a lot of wit in what Bob did in Gilligan's Island. It was physical.
Yeah.
Falling out of trees and tripping and all of that. And I look at his little body now when I watch it and think, oh, my gosh, he was so limber about everything he did. And yet he was into no pesticides. I'd say, Bobby, you look so tired today. What happened? He said, well, I had to name a spider farm last night. We had a spider farm, and we had to name all the spiders. So he was very in tune with kids. And I think that's what the soul of Gilligan came through.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it was such a fun, whimsical character that everybody kind of embraced and grew up with. What about Alan Hale?
Oh, he was a doll, and he was the same size as my father.
Is that right?
Every time he'd hug me, he'd kind of pick you up off the floor, you know, he was a great big jovial. Never saw him angry, never saw him temperamental. The professor and I were very close because we were and the rest. We send each other cards, love the rest all the time. But he had a great sense of humor. Actually, you think of Jim Backus, but in between takes, Russell was the funniest. The professor was the funniest.
What about Jim and Natalie? The Howells.
Oh, they were hysterical. I mean, Natalie and I were very close, and she was very much her character. Very much a character. Jim, for a comedian who don't usually share your humor, he'll say, Natalie, try it this way, you'll get a bigger laugh. Or sure, put a word with a K in it, it gets a bigger laugh. And at one point, Natalie said, every time we come off of the scene, Jim is just doing all this ad-libbing, and I don't know what to do. So Jim taught her how to ad-lib. And if you see the later episodes, they're both trying to outdo each other, coming out of the hut trying to ad-lib.
That's awesome. That's
but he
awesome.
Was very cheap. He had a lot of money. But he would ask Natalie and I know you read the book, but he would ask Natalie
yes.
and I to go to lunch. Then we go to lunch, and at the end of it, he'd say, oh, I forgot my credit card. I don't have my wallet. And at the end of the first season, Natalie presented him with
a bill.
With
a bill, yes.
You were
yes.
at lunch, Jim. And I don't think he ever paid her either.
Right. How about Tina? How about Tina Louise?
Well, Tina, you know, I was in awe because she was a beautiful, beautiful woman. And she knew what camera angle she wanted, and she ordered us the false eyelashes from New York. And she was glamorous all the time. And I don't say I envied that, but I was in awe of it. She was a little reserved, I guess. I think she really thought that it might have been more of a show about Ginger.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw a temper tantrum. I never saw any conflict with anything. But she was a little removed.
Yeah. Yeah, and she didn't, you know, I know later years she didn't participate in the reunion specials and all that good stuff as
no.
well. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, she wanted to kind of leave that behind us. And that's what I love about you is you know, although you've done so much theater over the years and so many other things in your life, and I know you're working on a cookbook and doing so many other things, you've embraced this character. And I love that, you know, there are some icons of vintage television that we all grew up with that really still embrace that character and appreciate what that time of their life was like.
Well, yes, and I had a wonderful time. I learned a lot. I made some money. We were one of the top 10 shows for quite a while. What do you want?
Yeah, right, right.
If you go into acting, what do you want? Nobody knows who you are. I wonder what they're doing now.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I felt lucky, and that's why I went back to stage to show I can do more than Marianne.
Sure. Now, I found some trivia points, Dawn. The show was filmed at CBS Studios, the same studio that was later home. The stage of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and Roseanne, and those lagoon scenes... We're in a parking lot, simply filled with water.
We tried to film at Malibu, and there was so much fog. So because we were such a hit, CBS dug a lagoon
really?
That little boats could come in out of, and they would take palm trees with moss covering the pots and orchids and things. For Monday and Tuesday, we'd be shooting outdoors. Wednesday and Thursday, Gunsmoke would come in, and they'd take the palm trees out and bring in tumbleweeds.
Wow.
And just about a year or two ago, they cemented it all over.
I know. I heard that. That's kind of a bummer. But that was a long time, like 47 years sitting on the lot, which is pretty cool. You know, the series itself was so whimsical. It was quaint, it was fun, and it was kind of a nice escape from daily life.
Well, and Bob was doing such physical comedy, and Alan kind of doing the Oliver Hardy thing. But also, I think that the cast was terrific. You didn't have to stop and think about anything. You laughed, and it was over. And we are the longest-running show in the history of television syndication. Never been off the air since 1964. And one of the reasons is there's no clothes or cars to tell you when it was filmed.
That's true. It's
1956 with a Chevy in the driveway. I mean, it's very, very different.
Very,
and everybody has a fantasy of wanting to be marooned, hence the Survivor and all that stuff that's happened since. Sherwood was very smart. I can't go anywhere in the world.
No, it's
anywhere
very
in the world without being a Marianne. It's amazing to me.
Well, it's very timeless. You're absolutely right. When you do something like that, it's very timeless. Now, you know, it held on to the ratings for all three seasons. You must have some favorite episodes yourself.
Oh, we love the dream sequences because we got to be other things, you know. And I remember, we got out the little Eliza Doolittle character with a Cockney accent, and I played an old witch, and that was always fun because you got away from your character. And then we had some very interesting guest stars, Don Rickles and Rory Calhoun, where Ginger and I just followed around this handsome man, whatever he was doing. He was so gorgeous. We didn't get that very often. But no, it was a great experience. You know, people say, well, it's just such a silly show. Well, it takes a lot to make a silly show.
Well, and they make a big deal these days when a series ends about the final episode and some closure. There was no closure. How did you find out the series was even canceled? It was intended to be renewed, wasn't it?
We were picked up for the fourth season. Scripts were purchased. We went on vacation, I don't know, March, something like that. And Sherwood called us in May and said they've canceled us. And the rumor is we were in the top 10. Why you would cancel somebody in the top 10 today, I don't know. But they had a half hour to fill. And Dennis Weaver had a pilot that didn't sell, and they were looking for another half hour show. And they decided to cancel Gunsmoke. And the head of CBS's wife was on vacation. Mm. And when she came back, she said, "You don't cancel Gunsmoke. I want it." So they canceled us.
Oh, wow.
Now, that's the rumor. I don't want to be sick, but that's the rumor that why we got Sherwood said, "I'm sorry, it's over." And that was a shock to everybody.
I bet. But then here's what I loved is there came the reunion movies and the rescue from Gilligan's Island. And it was one of the highest rated made-for-TV movies at that time. How fun was it getting back together? Was it almost surreal, like, oh, my God, we're going to do this all over again?
Yes, and some of the plots were stupid. Harlem Globetrotters, and I mean, some of that stuff. And they come in and play basketball and leave and don't know where they were. You know, I mean, that's about as close to reality as you can get, you know? But no, it was fun, and we're so happy to see each other. And when we came back, I don't know if you remember the episode, but the whole hut floated in the Santa Monica Pier.
Yeah, you tied all the huts together.
Tied them all together.
But see,
I mean, how
but see, after watching it for all those years and watching all the reruns, even a decade later, you know, it was cool to have some closure. You wanted to know how they were finally going to get off that island.
Yeah, and it would really kind of been that kind of neat to have us all go back to where we came from and see if you would adjust. But of course, that's too esoteric to even think about.
Yeah. Well, you know, here are some trivia points that I want to check with you that were just featured in Parade magazine in the Chicago Tribune. Number one was the Coast Guard would often receive telegrams from people who didn't realize the show wasn't real.
Well, we had the Coast Guard, not often, but the Coast Guard, Sherwood, our producer, stopped filming one day and he said, "The Coast Guard here and they want to talk to you." Five or six of the monkeys came in and said, "We have to tell you a true story. We keep getting calls and telegrams and letters saying there are seven people marooned in the Pacific Ocean. Why can't you find them?"
That's awesome.
Talk about believing what you see.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Number two. Now, this one you're going to have to tell me. Number two, Dawn Wells, Marianne, was the only cast member to receive compensation from the show's syndication.
I do not know where that came from.
Yeah.
And the Huffington Post questioned me, said, "You've got $1 million. I said, "Where?"
Well, your
husband negotiated. I said, "With whom?" Not a dime. Not one of us made a dime on the rerun.
That's amazing.
I understood that Sherwood Schwartz made over $90 million on the rerun.
Wow.
We didn't make a nickel. Not a nickel. So, no, unfortunately, I don't know why. Everybody, where that came from, I don't know.
All right. Number three was Raquel Welch auditioned also for the role of Marianne.
Well, I was told that, but okay. When we were at the big soundstage at CBS, and there were hundreds of people auditioning, probably 200 or 300, and I was told that on Thursday that Raquel came in to audition for Marianne. I never did see her, but she would have been a better Ginger than Marianne, so I don't know whether that's true or not. If I ever meet her, I'm going to ask that question, because I've heard that several times.
Yeah.
I didn't see her, so I don't know.
Number four, Gilligan's first name, though never mentioned on the show, was Willie?
There is a controversy about that. I don't think there ever really was one first name, and I think as time went on, they kind of tried to make that up, and I don't know. I never really asked Sherwood, but we never heard that first name.
Another wise tale. Number five, the original pilot had a Calypso theme song, different with lyrics by composer John Williams, who later went on to pen the score for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and Star Wars and so forth. I've seen that on YouTube. It was a completely, because Sherwood Schwartz was into, you know, he did the Brady Bunch and all these other shows where he told the story and the theme, which is such a tragedy that themes are such a small part of today's sitcoms and today's shows. But there was a much different theme in the beginning, in the pilot.
Well, and the pilot there was, and I remember when he tried, when CBS didn't want it. They said, this is the stupidest show we ever saw. And I think the head of CBS said, how are we going to know they're marooned every week? Sherwood said, well, we'll write a song. He said, what do you mean, we'll write a song? Well, come back to us and write a song. And Sherwood tells his story. He said, I don't sing. So he said, I sat down at the piano and tried to kind of create something. He came in with all the suits, with all the executives sitting there, and they said, okay, now tell us what it's going to be. And he's trying to sing the song without a piano, and he's going, bow, bow, you know, when the storm comes up and everything. And he said, I finished the song, and they all looked at me and said, thank you very much. And he got up and walked out of the room. So he created the story and created telling the story just before every episode.
Well, hope to see you in town soon. That was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for staying up with us tonight.
Thank you for being such a great interviewer. Have a great day.
All right, you too. We've got much more planned ahead on the show tonight, all coming up next on 720 WGN.
Danger, Will Robinson. Danger. No, Will Robinson. Danger.
All right, Dave Player back with you on 720 WGN. So Netflix is about to reboot a classic TV series almost 50 years in the making. The new Lost in Space debuted last Friday. And so we thought we'd take a step back in time and talk about the original 1960s series with one of its stars. He played young Will Robinson on the series, and that is Bill Mumy. Hello, Bill.
Well, thank you kindly, Dave. It's nice to be here.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about on how you got into acting at such a young age. I know you watched a lot of Zorro, you watched a lot of Superman growing up, you loved comic books. Guy Williams, who played your father in Lost in Space, by the way, was on Zorro. It made you want to do something adventurous, and television became something you really wanted to be a part of at a very young age.
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. That's true. What really was the catalyst for it actually becoming a reality was I broke my leg when I was 4 years old, and I broke my leg playing Zorro. But for, you know, 8-10 weeks, I was unable to run outside and play with my friends, so I was pretty much stuck to watching television all day, and in those days we had the Mickey Mouse Club, and we had Zorro, and we had the reruns of The Adventures of Superman, and those two caped adventurous superhero-type characters just resonated like a religion within my little brain, and I really wanted to get inside the TV and be an adventurer like Zorro and Superman, and you know, I was an only child, and my parents weren't intimidated or necessarily impressed by the entertainment business. My grandfather had been an agent of writers and directors in the 30s. Boris Karloff had been one of his clients.
Wow.
And he got the Frankenstein audition and negotiated that contract.
Very cool.
He had passed away before I was born, but from my mother's side of the family, she had been working at 20th Century Fox Studios for 11 years before I was born as a writer's secretary, and she'd grown up with it, having her father be an agent. So, you know, you can't escape your destiny. I was a little red-haired kid in West Los Angeles who really wanted to get inside the TV. So my dad said to my mom, well, you know, if you go with him and check it out, and if it makes everybody happy, go ahead. And pretty soon I was working very prolifically.
Well, I know, you know, I thought this was a very cool idea. Your mom said, okay, we're gonna let you, we're going to take you down to a romper room, a local romper room, and to see if you're comfortable even being in front of a camera. So she was dipping her toe in it. She was being very cautious. And obviously, it's something that you love doing. You did a couple of them. And by, you know, 1959, at the age of five, you got your first acting gig. A big one was Riverboat on NBC.
Right. That's true. And I do, when you look back on it, I do think that was very smart of my mom because, you know, it's one thing to be able to memorize some lines. It's another thing to, you know, maybe be able to stand still when you deliver them. But it's another thing to be under those lights and have a crew all around you and cameras in your face. A lot of people might balk at that experience. So she did sign me up for Romper Room, which, of course, any civilian kid could get on. And, yes, we did a double shift. I think I stayed on Romper Room for a couple of weeks as opposed to one. I was very comfortable, and I enjoyed it. So, yeah. And the only interesting thing about that Riverside episode was it was a television series starring Darren McGavin. I had a small part on that first episode, but years and years later, Marvel made the first Captain America movie in 1990, and I played the same character that Darren McGavin played. I played the character in World War II, and Darren McGavin played the character in modern day. So it was kind of a full circle thing between he and I there.
Yeah, you played with some great actors and actresses. We'll talk about that a little bit. But, you know, at the time you got into television, there wasn't as much live television as there was in the 50s, but you did have some experience behind the camera. You did a Bob Hope show. You did Jack Benny. You did Red Skelton, Jackie Gleason. That must have been wild because I have to imagine being on stage during a live television performance was it probably crazier and busier than you would even see on like a Broadway at that time.
It was a completely different arena and a completely different energy. Yeah, it's true. And even when I was, you know, 6, 7, 5 years old, that's when I did the bulk of those shows, Playhouse 90s and Tennessee Ernie Ford and the ones you mentioned. There was quite a few of those. Yeah, I wouldn't say stress level for a little kid, but you could definitely, it was amped up, you know, it was like, 3, 2, we are live, you know. I remember, this is a funny story, we were doing this Bob Hope television show live, and in this scene, it was Bob Hope, J.P. Morgan, myself and a handful of other kids. It was like a pre-Brady Bunch, like cheaper by the dozen kind of a sketch. He had a bunch of kids. And there was a dog in the scene. And again, we're doing live television. And the dog in the middle of this scene kind of walked up to the edge of the stage and took a dump. So, you know, you could see in the director's booth, you know, they get the camera off the dog, obviously, you know, because dogs do that little circle dance or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could see that they were freaking out to get the camera off the dog. So what was broadcast on television certainly didn't freak out America. But on the other hand, us on the stage were privy to exactly what was going on. So I remember that very well, thinking, wow, I'm sitting here watching this dog do its business while we're carrying on this kind of sitcom scene here.
Yeah, the excitement of live television. But, I mean, still so cool, though, Bill, that it was, you know, Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Jackie. I mean, these were the biggest names. And I just remember as a kid, and I grew up in the late 60s, so I discovered a lot of these shows in reruns and so forth. But it'd be like, hey, wait a minute, there's that kid from – Wait, there he is again. Like, you had a lot of great roles on some of the biggest shows of the 60s.
I did, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm also really glad that my parents and my agent at the time, they really made a conscious effort to say, after things started going, to say, look, one week he's doing a drama in a Hitchcock. The next week, he's doing a sitcom with Ozzie Nelson, or he's doing a Western on Have Gun, Will Travel, or he's playing a sick kid on Dr. Kildare or Ben Casey, or he's making a Disney movie. Let's not put him in a television series. Why should he
be nailed down
one of five characters on a sitcom where he comes in with a baseball and, you know, eats a cookie and then goes up to his room to do homework?
He's so true.
He's having this you know, I really had a wonderful education as an actor, working in all those different arenas of style and tone, and working with some of the most legendary directors and iconic stars, whether it's Lucille Ball or Jimmy Stewart or, I mean, all those people. I learned so much, and I got to play so many different types of characters that it was a great, great training ground. And when Lost in Space eventually came along, which was 5 years and change after I had started working, that was exactly what I had wanted to do in the first place. I mean, to me, Will Robinson was a little superhero.
Sure.
You know, he could fly a ship, he could program the robot, he was a good shot with a laser gun, he had a little, you know, space suit and a Flash Gordon suit. I mean, what kid wouldn't want to do that?
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. But even before that, though, Bill, you know, 1961 comes. You did what I would say one of the most memorable Twilight Zone episodes ever. You did several of them, but my favorite episode called It's a Good Life, probably one of the freakiest, most uncomfortable, you know, Twilight. I mean, those were so brilliantly written, but your role in that, I mean, that's makes the list of usually, you know, a top five, top ten of the best Twilight Zone episodes.
It does, and I'm very appreciative that I had the opportunity and was able to rise to the occasion. Those Twilight Zones are certainly the crown jewels in my show business tiara, in a way, because they really stand up so well. And that's that. What a super episode that was. Anybody who gets to work opposite Cloris Leachman, you know, it's like jamming with Jimi Hendrix or something. You know, it brings your game up a notch. She's such a great actress, and I've worked with her many, many times, and every time I realize what a gift it is. But, yeah, those Twilight Zones hold up well, and it's funny that you bring that up, because just yesterday I got a box of Anthony Fremont little action figures in the mail, that they're releasing these Anthony Fremont action figures now. So I have my Anthony Fremont action figure, my Will Robinson action figures, and my Lanier from Babylon 5 action figure.
That's awesome. No, that's very cool. And didn't you remake that episode on one of the reboots of the Twilight Zone with your daughter?
Yes. Well, yes and no. We didn't remake it. We did a sequel to it.
Okay.
Which was really cool. I mean, we simply took Ira Stephen Baer, who had produced Star Trek Deep Space Nine, was assigned the difficult job of producing UPN's 26 episodes of the new Twilight Zone back in 2004. Mm-hmm. And the network wanted to do a sequel to It's a Good Life. And I said I would do it only, you know, if I felt the script, something Rod Serling would have given a thumbs up to.
Absolutely.
And Ira wrote a great script. And, yeah, we took the simple perspective that little town of Peeksville, Ohio, was still there, although the population was even more diminished because Anthony Fremont, who is now 40 years old, you know, was still controlling them with the power of his mind and sending most of them away. It's only to find out that his daughter develops the same mental powers that he has, only to a higher degree. It's a great little 23-minute television. Really proud of that. And my daughter Liliana gave a fantastic performance. And again, to work with Cloris, what a treat.
So you even worked with Lucille Ball. What was working with Lucy like?
It was a dramatic television series that she owned. It was called The Greatest Show on Earth, and it was a television series that starred Jack Palance, and it was about the circus. And she owned the show, and it was her first hour-long dramatic guest appearance on television. You know, I worked with a lot of iconic names when I was little, but if I was working with, let's say, Claude Rains, mm-hmm. my mother would say to me, "Oh, you're working with Claude Rains. He's such a fabulous actor," right? Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't care. I don't mean that I didn't have respect for people, but I mean, I wouldn't care because I hadn't seen his catalog of work.
Sure.
You know, "Oh, you're working with, you know, Red Buttons." Oh, okay. You know, again, I don't care. What do I know?
You're a young kid, exactly.
But you're working with Lucy, Now, that's a whole different thing. The only two people when I was really little, like 7, 8, 9 years old, that I was maybe a little apoplectic or nervous or impressed by was working with Walt Disney and working with Lucy, because they were iconic things, that stars that were very familiar to me because I'd grown up seeing them every day or every week. So working with Lucy was great, actually. It was the two of us starred in this hour-long episode. And one little thing I remember about her, which was very cool, is we were shooting over Halloween one day. And at about 3 o'clock, right after lunch, we've shot a couple of things after lunch, and then Lucy said, you know what? I know my kids want to go trick-or-treating on Halloween, and I'll bet Billy does too. So we're going to wrap out early today, and we'll pick it up tomorrow.
Oh, gosh, how cool is
and,
that?
And yeah. I thought that was really, you know, when you look back on that and you realize, well, there's, what, a crew of 40 people or something working on a television show, and
sure.
Here the owner of the show turns around and says, nah, everybody go home, go trick-or-treating, let the kids go. And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
That was really nice of her.
Absolutely
the
awesome.
The other thing I remember about her really is that she chain-smoked, and that her natural speaking tone was so low.
Yeah, I bet it was. Vivian, come here for a second. I got to talk to you. We heard it over the years, and it got progressively low over the rest of her career, too. Yeah. Now, you were on so many of these shows. I mean, you were hopping from show to show, you know, really developing new characters at such a young age. How did you learn your lines at such a young age? Is that just something that came naturally to you?
It really, honestly did. And still does. That's I don't want to thank some system. I don't want to act like it's not legitimate. It's just a gift. You know, some kids can pick up a baseball and throw it fast and straight. Some kids can pick up a paintbrush and draw a picture of a horse and it looks like a real horse. You know,
I happen to be able
to memorize stuff and say it with belief. That's all I can say. It's just the way I am.
That's very cool. No, that's actually very cool. Now, you did an episode of The Munsters. You were the first choice to play Eddie, actually, but that wasn't for you.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure when that first got told, that little story, but I'm almost sorry it was told, because I always have to say that. And I know Butch Patrick is a good friend of mine. He's done such a great job. He is Eddie Munster. I hate to think that, you know, they wanted someone else besides Butch, because Butch was perfect for the gig. But my family agreed that wasn't the right gig for us. Again, we didn't really want to just be fourth banana on a series, because we were doing such eclectic work. And also, the makeup was the main reason why we said no. Nobody wanted me, including myself, to be, you know, turned into a werewolf every morning.
Hours in makeup. Hours in makeup.
Which, of course, came back to bite me karmically, because I did Babylon.
You did it. You did. But you were older. You were older at that point, yeah.
Yeah, but Butch was great, and he's still a good friend of mine, and I'm glad I did that Munsters. It's a pretty funny show.
It is. And then you did, you know, Antenna TV. I don't know when this was. It was sometime within the last year I was watching. They have Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. You were on, like, back-to-back. It was like you were in a couple Bewitched, but you played Darren in one episode. Then you were on I Dream of Jeannie. I don't know about you, but when I watched those shows as a kid, I had a crush on both of them. So I don't know, Elizabeth Montgomery and Barbara Eden, I don't know how you got through that at being such a young age, but...
Listen, you won't believe what, you know, little kids can form, whether it's like their school teachers or whatever, you get a big crush on grown-up. Within a couple of years, I went from being madly in love with Shirley Jones, because we did a film called A Diglish Affair together. Oh, I was so in love with Shirley. And then I went straight into a movie called Palm Springs Weekend, and I fell so in love with Connie Stevens. Then I went straight from Connie Stevens to Bridget Bardot, where I was the first actor to get an on-screen kiss with Bridget Bardot. That was a very powerful couple of days for me, I'll tell you.
I bet.
And then you know, straight into Elizabeth Montgomery, who I worshipped, I had such a crush on, and she couldn't have been sweeter and nicer. And to get to play her husband
I know, was hysterical.
I mean, come on, I was so happy to do that. That was one of my favorite acting experiences. Well, that show holds up pretty good.
It does.
That not too long ago.
It does.
Yeah, I thought I did a. I saw that episode. It's called Junior Executive. When I became Darren not too long ago, and I thought it held up really well. I was kind of proud of my performance there. I loved being her husband. And it's a very good Trivial Pursuit kind of question, you know. Name the three actors to play Darren Stevens.
That's very good. I like that. I like that. That'll stump some people. I like that very much. Now, all these shows, you've done all these shows. Now, finally, you know, you get a regular gig on Lost in Space. You finally get this regular gig on Lost in Space, which is celebrating 50 years this week. How did you get the role? How did that come about?
It was offered to me. I didn't audition for it. At that point in time, you know, without sounding egotistical, in those days, like, if you couldn't get Ronnie Howard, you got me. if you couldn't get me or Ronnie Howard, then you went fishing.
Yeah,
but everything was pretty... it was all pretty much offered to me and Ronnie first. Of course, Ronnie was doing Andy Griffith in terms of a series commitment. I had just wrapped a film with Jimmy Stewart called Dear Bridget, which was a 20th Century Fox film. 20th Century Fox was packaging Lost in Space. Irwin Allen took a look at some of my work, and the part was offered to me. And we all immediately decided, yes, we will accept this, because, it was exactly what had motivated me to become an actor and get into the TV in the first place, to be an adventurer, superhero like that.
All right, there's more with Bill Mumy next on 720 WGN. Bill, I know the early days of the series were focused on the family, but it quickly turned to Will and Dr. Smith and the robot. I mean, that's where I think the most action came into play, and you were always curious to know where these three were heading.
It's funny, isn't it, how certain shows end up revolving around a trinity. You know, whether it's Bones and Spock and Kirk, or whether it's Luke Skywalker and R2-D2 and C-3PO, somehow or another, Lost in Space became that trinity of Smith, the robot, and Will Robinson. And I had no problem with that. You know, it was great working with Jonathan and Bobby Day, and I loved having a lot to do. But I always favored the earlier episodes of the show, tone-wise, because they were darker and they felt more realistic.
They were in black and white, weren't they?
Yeah, we had a great cinematographer the first season named Gene Polito, and his black and white stuff, wait till you see it on the Blu-ray. It looks beautiful. I mean, it looks as good as, like, Frankenstein or one of the great 30s movies. It's really well lit and shadowy. But the show certainly placed in what was called a family hour by the network. PBS originally aired the show at 7:30 to 8:30 on Wednesday nights, and they demanded that there be nothing in the show that would scare little kids. And in the first few episodes, you know, it's actually quite not that way. It is pretty scary.
Yeah, right.
And they start getting some phone calls and some complaints that it was too scary for the family hour. So the network mandated that the show tone lighten up. And that was when Jonathan Harris also very wisely realized that if he continued to play the character of Dr. Smith as a saboteur, snarling villain who was actually out to sabotage children and everything, he'd quickly be off the show. They'd kill him off or something. So he started to sneak in a little more of the comedy into his work, and both the network and Irwin Allen, our producer, came to him and said, "Know what you're doing, do more of it." And also, it was 1965, 1966, what a global revolution there was in terms of entertainment. You know, the Beatles were in high gear, folk rock was kicking in, you were just on the burgeoning reality of psychedelia, Richard Nixon was on Laugh-In, you had Batman coming on, which was actually on the same time as Lost in Space. It was very high camp, and we kind of just joined that pop art, that brief period, and history that's a really unique time.
Well, the new Netflix reboot of Lost in Space debuted last Friday, and the 1960s classic Lost in Space series is available on DVD, and you can catch Lost in Space late night Saturdays on MeTV. Thank you, Bill.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It's been a nice time, and obviously you've tickled my ego, and I appreciate that. And thanks to all the fans for over 50 years who have, kept me going.
Well, thank you. It's always you pop up on television constantly. You're watching Antenna TV, MeTV, any of the classics. You're all over the place. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Well, thanks. I got around.
You did get around. Thanks again, Bill. I appreciate it.
Okay, cheers.
Cheers to you. All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN.